is VOA News via remote.
I'm Laurel Bowman. Armenian President Armen Sarkisian said Saturday he had refused to sign an order from the prime minister to dismiss the army's chief of staff, deepening a national political crisis. The ex-Soviet nation has faced turmoil since Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan signed a Moscow-brokered peace deal in November, sealing a humiliating defeat to Azerbaijan after 6 weeks of fighting over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. Divisions widened Thursday when the prime minister defied a call by the military to resign, accused the army of an attempted coup, and ordered the chief of the general staff to be fired. On Saturday, the country's president said that he would not back the sacking, saying the political crisis won't be resolved through personnel changes. Earlier in the day, 5,000 opposition protesters waving Armenian flags and calling for the prime minister's resignation gathered in the capital, Yerevan. Gunmen in Nigeria on Saturday released 27 teenage boys who were kidnapped from their school last week in the northern state of Niger, while security forces continued to search for more than 300 schoolgirls abducted in a nearby state. Schools have become targets for mass kidnappings for ransom in northern Nigeria by armed groups, many of whom carry guns and ride motorcycles. And Chinese officials have signaled that Beijing plans sweeping electoral changes for Hong Kong, possibly as soon as next week, when China's parliament, the National People's Congress, opens in Beijing. And Britons bid farewell in a televised funeral Saturday to Captain Tom Moore, the 100-year-old war veteran who raised millions of dollars for the health service in the pandemic. This is VOA News. In Myanmar on Saturday, police launched their most sweeping crackdown in 3 weeks of protests against military rule in towns and cities across Myanmar. One woman was shot and dozens of people were detained. Three domestic media outlets said earlier that the woman shot in the central town of Monwa had died, but an ambulance service official said she was in the hospital. The circumstances of the shooting were not clear, and police were not available for comment. Friday's U.S. airstrikes against Iran-backed militias in eastern Syria encouraged terrorism in the region. That's what Iran's top security official said Saturday. Washington said the strikes on positions of the Kataib Hezbollah paramilitary group along the Iraq border were in response to rocket attacks against U.S. targets in Iraq. Bangladesh is under no obligation to shelter 81 Rohingya Muslim refugees adrift for almost 2 weeks on the Andaman Sea and being assisted by neighboring India, said Bangladesh's foreign minister. India's Coast Guard found the 81 survivors and 8 dead, crammed onto a crippled fishing boat, and were trying to arrange for Bangladesh to take them, Indian officials told media. Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler approved an operation to capture or kill murdered journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018, according to a U.S. intelligence report released on Friday. The United States imposed sanctions on some of those involved, but spared the crown prince himself in an effort to preserve relations with the kingdom. Khashoggi was a U.S. resident who wrote opinion columns for the Washington Post, which were critical of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's policies. He was killed and dismembered by a team of operatives linked to the prince in the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Archaeologists have uncovered a unique ancient Roman ceremonial carriage from a villa just outside Pompeii. That's the city buried in a volcanic eruption in 79 AD. The almost perfectly preserved four-wheeled carriage made of iron, bronze, and tin was found near the stables of the ancient villa. And in a televised funeral, Britons bid farewell Saturday to Captain Tom Moore. He's the 100-year-old veteran who became a global hero after raising millions for the health service in Britain during the coronavirus pandemic. For more on these and other stories, please visit our website at voanews.com. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
Borno State, we saw the suicide bombing that went on a few days ago. Is that the way their lives will be wasted? Is it because they are not touching them? They are in government. They are not touching them. They will feel that because these are poor people and nothing will be done, because we have a nation where when you are poor, you are faceless, nameless and voiceless. It's not acceptable.
A Nigerian activist calls for a protest to demand the resignation of President Muhammadu Buhari.
All the judges of the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeal and the High Court in Uganda are appointed by Mr. Museveni, and so he has got an overarching influence on all these people.
A Ugandan presidential candidate welcomes calls for an independent investigation into allegations of voter irregularities and rigging of the recent elections.
We have many people in Zambia. The majority of people do agree with us that come 12 August this year, they will vote for UPND and Hagainde Hichilema as our president.
And Zambia's main opposition party chooses Mutale Nalumango as its new vice president. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A prominent Nigerian activist is calling for a protest to demand the resignation of President Muhammadu Buhari and his administration. Aisha Yusufu says the president and his team have failed to carry out their core constitutional duty to protect the lives and property of Nigerians. Her comments come after the police confirmed the abduction of 317 students by gunmen in Zamfara State in northwestern Nigeria Friday. Officials say the police have since launched a rescue operation to free the kidnapped students. The government is coming under intense criticism following the kidnapping. Critics have expressed concern about growing insecurity across the country. Aisha Yusufu tells me that the latest abduction of school children is unacceptable.
It is my reaction to the abduction yet again in Nigeria is one of anguish, one of anger, one of, you know, pain, because this is what we've been on this for almost 7 years. Chibok girls abduction will be 7 years on April 14th, 2021, and yet we learned nothing. For how long are we going to continue to have all of this mass abduction? And we seem to have a president and a commander-in-chief who is clueless and does not even care about what is happening in the nation and the pain that people are going through. Yesterday, we buried 7 military officers that died in a plane crash just minutes away from the president. Yet the president couldn't leave the villa to even go and commiserate with the families of the victims. It's annoying what is going on, because at the end of the day, it seems as if we didn't learn anything from Chibok girls abduction, and it's really sad.
I understand some people are calling for protests yet again. What is your take?
Well, the thing is that the president is not doing what he needs to do. And so the president needs to leave. If he cannot handle security of this country, because the primary responsibility of every government is the protection of life and property. And if the president and commander-in-chief cannot handle that, he should leave. He should resign. He should be impeached by the National Assembly. And earlier today, I said to Nigerians, look, when we are ready, when we are tired, sick and tired of the atrocities that are going on in our country, where terrorists are the ones who are coming at us with impunity, behaving with such brazenness, when we are all tired of it, we will march en masse to the villa, stay there and make the march for the president to resign. We will not care about the bullets that they will send in by military to shoot at us, because we're already being killed anyway.
But at this rate of the global coronavirus pandemic going on with lockdowns, would it be a right strategy, some people argue, to call for a protest to go to the Aso Rock to demand for the resignation of the president?
It might not be a right strategy in the sense that, yes, there's a global pandemic going on, but guess what? We are being killed more by terrorists and security agents than by the virus itself. And one of the things that we've had, even though, yes, we have virus here, it's not been as
deadly as it has been in some other countries. And with markets are going on, markets are open, political gatherings are happening. So is the demand for good governance going to be different? People are supposed, and one of the things, even when people protest, they must protest responsibly. They must wear their face mask. They must keep their distance. And then at the end of the day, make demand. So it's either we are killed by terrorists or we are killed by the virus. We have to choose one.
Ms. Yusufu, some people are saying that the government has come out with, you know, a new team of service chiefs, and that, you know, they've been doing the best that they can to reduce the growing insecurity in the country, to combat these terrorists or repelling armed attacks. Why do you think this is not enough?
Well, I would say for those people, when they are abducted by terrorists or killed by terrorists, they can tell us from the grave or from where they are with the terrorists. I think it's very easy for people to talk when they are not victims. You said something just now. Our military, they are repelling the terrorists. Why is our military waiting for the terrorists to attack before they repel? When you are not on the offensive, you're on the defensive, it means you are the one who does not have a strategy. There's no leadership. There's no strategic attack. So it is the terrorists that are controlling the narrative and the way this war is going. That's not the way it's supposed to be. We want a military that will be on the offensive. We might want a military that will be after the terrorists. We want a military that will ensure that the terrorists do not even have a place to stay, talk less of mounting attacks and going to abduct school children the way they have been doing it in the last few months.
So what do you think is the best step for the government to take at this moment to prevent such occurrences?
One of the things that needs to be done is to ensure that all the schools are secured. The intelligence gathering should be made top-notch so that we begin to know what is happening. Then at the same time, there should be an offensive on the terrorists. Why is it that in Nigeria, we sort of like repel? Our military will go repel, and then they will leave the place and go on. Why are we not systematically going after the terrorists, taking the places for them, dislodging them, and ensuring that we secure these places? When they have been secured, the police can be in place. Why the military go ahead to continue to drive away the terrorists? Why is this attack we repel, and then the military move away, the terrorists come back, they gain their ground, and then the attacks continue? People are being killed all over Nigeria, but no state. We saw the suicide bombing that went on a few days ago. Is that the way their lives would be wasted? Is it because they are not touching them? They are in government. They are not touching them. They will feel that because these are poor people and nothing will be done, because we have a nation where when you are poor, you are faceless, nameless and voiceless. It's not acceptable.
Aisha Yusufu is a prominent Nigerian activist. She spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. The presidential candidate for Uganda's Opposition Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, is welcoming calls for an independent investigation into allegations of rigging in the recent presidential and legislative elections. Patrick Oboy Amuriat, who also says he is a victim of human rights violations, says there's evidence that the military and police officers carried out gross human rights abuses during the election process. His remarks follow the U.S. call for an independent, credible, impartial and thorough inquiry into allegations of voter irregularities in the East African country's recent presidential vote. Meanwhile, Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, also known as Bobi Wine, has withdrawn his court challenge disputing the outcome of the polls. Representatives of the party say it appears they are not likely to receive a fair hearing. Patrick Oboy Amuria tells me that only an independent investigation can determine those responsible for the alleged voter irregularities, rigging, and human rights abuses.
Is something that we welcome as a political party, and I believe the other opposition groups in Uganda would warm up to.
Ofondo Opondo, a prominent supporter of the government, is saying the U.S. cannot teach Uganda how to run its elections. What is your reaction to Ofondo Opondo's statement?
Mr. Ofondo Opondo needs to know that Uganda is part of the global village, and it is signatory to a number of protocols, national protocols on democracy and human rights and other forms of protocols that are available. Being signatory to this protocols, we commit ourselves, it's the bare minimum standards respecting these protocols. And I think Mr. Fono Pondo should not be blind to that fact.
Some opposition parties have also called for an investigation into this. Your supporters are saying you were a victim of some of these acts. What is your take about the call for an investigation into the alleged atrocities committed during the election process?
Well, of course, I do not know whether there is anything really to be investigated, because the torture of Ugandans, including the Ugandans realized at the hands of the police and the military, is well documented here in Uganda. The presence of safe houses, the people who have been recorded as having disappeared. Authorities here have admitted the cases of citizens disappearing, and they have actually admitted that they are holding some of the Ugandan citizens who have since gone missing. But, you know, in as far as this election is concerned, the torture during the campaigns is well documented by the media. You know, this was not an election. It was war that was subjected by the authorities on the people. And we as candidates, particularly I would like to speak about myself, I got arrested and incarcerated several times during the 5 days of campaigns. I was also arraigned in court 3 times on Trump and Tyres. One time, you know, being taken to court in Western Uganda. After that, beyond the hours of operation of any court in Uganda. So I think that this is something that we in the political opposition should be able to provide evidence to the auditors.
Now, Patrick, your colleague or rival presidential candidate Robert Kyagulanyi has withdrawn his court petition of the outcome of the elections. You decided it's unnecessary to go to the court. Are you saying you are vindicated?
Well, precisely. One thing that needs to be understood is that the Honorable Kyagulanyi is very, very young in politics. He's hardly 3 years old in politics. And his rise in politics is premised on the foundation that we as a political group laid in preparing Ugandans not to take over their country. And so, really, he wrote on that, of course, a celebrity status as a musician and a young person, and also aided by, you know, other factors could have propelled him upward. But really, in terms of political experience, he does lack this. And so it should have been of great benefit for him to listen to us. From the very beginning, he raised the hopes of people about the election, being able to bring change to this country, despite the fact that he knows very well that the several times that we have engaged Mr. Museveni, we have actually defeated Mr. Museveni at his own game, but neither have we been announced winner nor handed over power. Going to the court of law is like going through another election where the adjudicator is Museveni, because all the judges of the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeal and the High Court in Uganda are appointed by Mr. Museveni. And so he has got an overarching influence on all these people.
Patrick Oboye Amuriat is the presidential candidate for Uganda's Opposition Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development, or UPND, has chosen Mutale Nalumango as its vice president. Ms. Nalumango, who is a former cabinet minister, previously worked with several women's empowerment groups. Activists and civil society groups are hailing the announcement as a positive step, which they say will empower women and young Zambian girls to aim high. Nalumango's election follows a vote by UPND members to choose representatives, including Hakainde Hichilema, the presidential candidate to lead the party in the upcoming August polls. To learn more about her reaction and anticipated contribution to the UPND's electoral prospects, I reached Ms. Nalumango in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
This new position that has been given to me means a lot of responsibility on my shoulders. A responsibility to help Hakainde Hichilema, the vision carrier of our party, to carry the vision for our nation, to support him in ensuring that indeed our nation makes a transition from the current, I'll call inept government, into a government led by President Hakainde Hichilema. That means persuading our people to do the right thing and vote properly on the 12th of August this year. That is the biggest, to help unify our party and later on unify our nation.
Ms. Mutale,
yes, sir.
My question to you is,
yes,
what
sir.
Do you bring to the table? What makes you special enough for Hakainde Hichilema to choose you as the vice president of the party?
I wished I could enter his heart. But what do I bring, according to my own understanding, is that I bring with me simplicity of life, the whole package of a woman, that is love, caring for the people that you are supposed to serve. I bring to the table integrity that culminates into credibility of governance. The little that I've done in life is that I've been in government before. I've been a minister in government. I have been a speaker, maybe in America. You think of Nancy, deputy to Nancy. That is the work I've done. So I bring with me a little experience in governance and governing for the sake of the people you govern. I bring to the table issues that are against the corruption. I hate corruption with passion.
How significant a choice is this? And what impact do you think your elevation would have on women and girl children in Zambia?
I am a teacher by profession. And the little work I've done is that I've interacted with women. And like I've said, I'm a strong believer in the women leadership, which is shepherdhood. Not cowboy, my dear, shepherdhood. And therefore, women in Zambia right now, a number, I can't say all the women, are excited because I've worked with a number of them. And therefore, there is hope. I feel that there is a bit of energy in the hope that people have, that we come in. In fact, we were said that we have achieved 50-50 at the topmost in our party. By the president picking on a woman, that means the first two positions are shared equally.
Some people are suggesting that your elevation as the vice president of the party might not necessarily give the UPND the much needed momentum to win this year's general election. Others are saying it will. What do you think your chances are being the vice president of the party to win this year's election?
The opinions are normal. It is human for the two opinions to come through. Others saying this may, like I've been saying, energize and give us even a little bit better. Whether it's by a percentage, the appointment has brought, has made us a little better, giving us more, a little more chance of winning the election. But those that may be our adversaries, we want to see it as negative and we'll paint it as negative. So, Peter, this is normal reaction in society. There is no way everybody will say, wow, now we are going. But let me say this through you, that I am extremely confident that we are going to win. Other than just the inclusion of a woman, I think as our party, our vision has become clearer to the Zambian people. And our colleagues have lamentably failed. Yes, from the beginning, our formation is that we needed to bring our vision into government and therefore improve the livelihoods of our people, the economy of our people. But the urgency of it is that now those that are in office are even failing miserably and we can't wait. It has to be now. And we have many people in Zambia, the majority of people do agree with us that come 12th August this year, they will vote for UPND and Hagainde Hichilema as our president.
Mutale Nalumango is the new vice president of the Zambian main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND. She spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Meanwhile, the Electoral Commission of Zambia is dismissing allegations that it is planning to rig the August 12 general election. The electoral body says it will continue to work to address the concerns of political parties and other stakeholders before the polls. This after opposition groups accused the commission of doing the bidding of the Governing Patriotic Front, or PF, an accusation officials deny. Critics say the electoral body has not been forthcoming with information about the voter list it recently compiled for the election. They argue that the lack of information is part of the plan to manipulate the outcome of the polls. For reaction about opposition concerns about the upcoming vote, I reached Patricia Luhanga, Corporate Affairs Manager at the Electoral Commission of Zambia.
The Electoral Commission of Zambia has been doing quite a lot of work in readiness for the 2021 August polls. And just maybe quickly, let me indicate to you that we have shared the election calendar with a stakeholder, and this is going activity by activity to just also prepare the various political parties, as well as everybody else who would want to hold a stake in the election. So the commission has been on the ground. We started with the voter registration exercise last year, and this took place between the 9th of November to the 20th of December for a period of 38 days. And later on, we retreated to look at the consolidation of the data from the registration kits and be able to do the cleanups and the deduplication of this data. Currently, we are undergoing the electronic inspection of the register of voters, and this is the provisional register, as it hasn't yet been certified. Then later on, we'll have the physical inspection, we'll have the certification of the register, we'll run into the presidential nominations, as well as that of mayor, member of parliament, councils, the wards, in good time for the campaign period, as well as the general election slated for the 12th of August, 2021.
When will the voter register be ready ahead of the elections?
We have slated the electronic inspection of the voter details, and this is a process where all registered voters can verify that the details are correct. And in the event that there is something missing or they would like to change the polling station, they will be able to do this during the physical inspection. Now, the provisional register inspection opened on the 7th of February, and it will run up to the 7th of May, 2021. The physical inspection of the provisional register will take place between the 29th of March to the 2nd of April, 2021. After that process, then we'll be sure that the details that are appearing are details that have been verified. Therefore, the commission will handle the voter register certification on the 9th of May, 2021. So those are the timeframes that we have given for us to be able to give the current register.
Justin Pombere Mumba, chief spokesperson for Movement for Better Zambia, a political opposition group, has been highly critical of the Electoral Commission, rating an op-ed about it in the Zambian media. UPND, United Party for National Development, the major opposition party, has also been sharply critical of the Electoral Commission. Actually, they rejected the outcome of the previous election. So how do you engage these people with these criticisms that they are leveling against the Electoral Commission? They appear not to be satisfied with your engagement. How do you resolve this?
You'll understand, Peter, that the Electoral Commission of Zambia operates within defined laws, and we cannot go beyond the expectation. We have noticed that our various stakeholders have various needs, and these vary from stakeholder to stakeholder. And when that happens, you'll find that sometimes the things that are being requested for are things that we cannot offer. They are outside the law, for instance. So what we get to do in such situations is to continuously engage. And the commission has been very consistent. Regardless of these criticisms that have been happening, and obviously these things are going in the media, we also recognize they've got the freedom of expression. But once we pick any issue that we want to talk to them about, or that they are critical of the commission about, we do engage. So for us, the key word is continuous engagement. For us to be able to understand their side of the story, to understand what their needs are and for us to see how we can find a common ground to move forward.
What assurances are you giving these stakeholders so their concerns will be resolved in the run-up to the elections, briefly?
So if we look at the concerns, maybe you give me the specifics, what those concerns are, so I can address them one by one.
Well, one, I'll give you an example. They expressed concern about the fact that the Electoral Commission has not been forthcoming with information regarding the voter registration, and that the Electoral Commission reluctantly extended the voter registration process after enormous pressure brought on you, and that the ECZ is basically doing the bidding of the ruling Patriotic Front Party or perhaps the government, and that the elections will be rigged in favor of the PF. These are some of the criticisms they are leveling against the Electoral Commission of Zambia. How do you address them?
To the contrary, first of all, I must emphasize the fact that the Electoral Commission of Zambia is a very autonomous organization. We operate independently, away from interference, regardless of how people look at these processes. And the way we do operate, we are backed by the law. We draw our powers from the Constitution and various subsidiary laws that govern the electoral process in the country. Stakeholders, we have been engaging them. And when you speak to the issue of the commission not forthcoming on voter registration figures, we have been consistent. In the various meetings we've held, whatever platform we are given, we have shared with the stakeholders that the commission does not want to release these figures prematurely. The reason is very simple.
Patricia Luhanga is the Corporate Affairs Manager at the Electoral Commission of Zambia. She spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, according to data from the United Nations, Africa's Sahel countries have the highest rate of child marriage in the world, with more than half of all girls being married before the age of 18. For VOA, Henry Wilkins reports from Burkina Faso on a former child bride who fled her 54-year-old husband and now mentors other child marriage survivors.
Vivian Sawadogo, whose name has been changed to protect her identity, lives in Burkina Faso. Her family forced her into marriage at age 12. She'd been promised from birth to the man's family in exchange for a child bride his family had given to hers some years earlier. But her husband was a man in his 50s who had already had four wives, and Sawadogo decided to escape what she described as a curse. One morning, she says, she left the house and walked from 8 a.m. to 11 p.m, covering over 30 kilometres. But she was caught and taken back to the house, feeling completely devastated. She says she was determined not to give up, however, and made another attempt. That night, she walked more than 40 kilometres before finding a bus which allowed her to escape. After her escape, she found refuge in a centre set up by a church for girls fleeing child marriage. She lived here for 10 years and was able to continue her education. Sawadogo is now a 22-year-old university student. She's left the centre but returns regularly to mentor younger girls, like this one who also escaped through the bush alone and whose identity we are protecting. She says she left the man she had been given to because she didn't love him and because he already had three wives and children. She's been living at the centre for a few months, where she is clothed, fed and also able to attend school, something she says makes her very happy. Cultural practices like gifting daughters to other families are common in the Sahel, as is the kidnapping of young girls for marriage. Non-profit groups like Save the Children are working to eliminate child marriage, but say financial support and empowerment of the girls is an essential part of stopping it. Tamani Saleh Issoufou works on the issue for Save the Children in Burkina Faso. He says they believe the reason the girls are given up for marriage is because the parents think they do not have the means to support them within the family. When a girl is given in marriage, We have to find a way to empower her, he adds. Save the Children provides cash handouts to families to ensure girls continue their education and also helps train the girls so they can get jobs. Meanwhile, Burkina Faso's government says careful monitoring by citizens is also essential to prevent child marriage. Soumaïla Sarko from Burkina Faso's Ministry for Women, Families and Humanitarian Affairs says the country has set up more than 800 watch cells in at least 872 villages to report child marriages to authorities and has also sensitized more than 4 million people on the phenomenon of child marriage. But it's an uphill battle. Sister Veronique Cansono, the nun who runs the Refuge Centre for Girls, says the conflict raging across the Sahel since 2012 has only made matters worse. She says this week alone, the centre welcomed 4 girls. There are other weeks when 6 arrive, which she says is too much. There are already 110 girls living at the centre. She's surprised the numbers have gotten worse rather than decreasing. Despite the obstacles, Sawadogo says escaping child marriage is vital. Had she not escaped, she says, her life would be miserable. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Burkina Faso.
High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bartlett warns a proliferation of human rights violations around the world is eroding fundamental freedoms and heightening grievances that are destabilizing. She presented a global update Friday to the UN Human Rights Council. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Human Rights Chief Michelle Bartlett zipped through a long litany of global offenders during her address Friday. No region was spared. Few countries emerged with clean hands. She criticized repressive policies in powerful countries such as Russia, which she said enacted new legal provisions late last year that further limited fundamental freedoms.
Existing restrictive laws have continued to be harshly enforced, including during recent demonstrations across the country. On several occasions, police were filmed using unnecessary and disproportionate force against largely peaceful protesters and made thousands of arrests.
She noted problems in the U.S. with systemic racism. She took the European Union to task for anti-migrant restrictions that put lives in jeopardy. She denounced the shrinking civic space across Southeast Asia, condemning the military coup in Myanmar and death squads in the Philippines. She condemned corrupt, discriminatory and abusive practices in Venezuela, Honduras, and other countries in the Americas that have forced millions of people to flee for their lives. She deplored the terrible suffering of millions of people victimized by conflicts in the Middle East. Specifically, Bartlett expressed concern about alleged abuses committed by all parties in Ethiopia's Tigray region. She called for a credible investigation into allegations of mass killings, extrajudicial executions, and other attacks on civilians, including sexual violence in the province.
I'm also disturbed by reported abductions and forcibly returns of Eritrean refugees living in Tigray, some reportedly at the hands of Eritrean forces. At least 15,000 Eritreans who had taken refuge are unaccounted for following the destruction of their shelters. Coupled with growing insecurity in other parts of Ethiopia, the conflict in Tigray could have serious impact on regional stability and human rights.
Bartlett called on the Ugandan government to refrain from using regulations to combat COVID-19 to arrest and detain political opponents and journalists. And she warned of the dangers posed by apparent official attempts in neighboring Tanzania to deny the reality of COVID-19.
Including measures to criminalize recognition of the pandemic and related information. This could have serious impact on Tanzanians' rights to health. I note reports of pushbacks of hundreds of asylum seekers from Mozambique and the DRC, as well as continued reports of torture and forced disappearances and forced returns of Burundian refugees.
Bartlett noted people in every region of the world were being left behind and excluded from development and other opportunities as the coronavirus pandemic continued to gather pace. She said building trust and maintaining and expanding freedoms were central to global efforts to contain and crush the coronavirus. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Linguists and Braille experts in Mali have translated the country's most widely spoken African language, Bambara, into Braille for the country's blind. Bambara is spoken and understood by about 15 million Malians, even more than the colonial French, making it an important step for blind people. For VOA, Annie Reisenberg profiles a teacher of the new translation in this report from the Malian capital, Bamako.
Moussa Keita has been at the Malian Union of the Blind, UMAV, since childhood, first as a student and now as a teacher. He is one of six instructors who will soon teach Braille in Bambara, the country's most widely spoken language. Before now, students learned Braille in Mali's colonial language, French. In the shade of a tree by his classroom on the UMAV campus, Keita explains his pride in Bambara Braille.
Quand je pense, n'est-ce pas, au projet qui a pensé non seulement au handicapé visuel.
When I think of this project, he says, that thought not just of the visually handicapped, but moreover, that thought of Africans, particularly of Malians, to write Braille in their own language, to try and adapt Braille to Bambara, which isn't even the official language. Really, it's a feeling of pride and joy for us. Keita's student, 15-year-old Abdoulaye Kane, explains the usefulness of Bambara Braille to him in the classroom. He says that now, if you don't understand how to write something in French, you can write and read the word in Bambara. Then, you can understand how to write it in French, he says. Abdoulaye Diallo is a blind physical therapist and a Braille specialist. Diallo writes prescriptions and patient information on paper with a tool called a slate and stylus. The Braille is then translated into written French by clinic staff. Taking a pause from treating patients, Diallo sits behind his clinic and talks about how teaching Braille in Bambara is a breakthrough for students and for blind adults who never had the chance to go to school. If I'm an adult, illiterate, and I'm going to learn Bambara, he says, but I can see, I learn Bambara and I can do whatever I want. He says, if I'm an adult, but I'm blind, and I don't know Bambara, I'm in the margins. So, it's this Bambara Braille, he says, which will save, which will give autonomy to all these people who were in the margins. Isiaka Balo, a linguist expert at the University of Bamako, was contacted in 2019 by a nonprofit group called Sightsavers to spearhead the project to adapt Braille to Bambara. Bambara has more letters than the French alphabet and more intonation, so new letters had to be created, but only within the 6 points available in the Braille cell. Speaking from the Braille printing room at UMAV, Balo says blind students in Mali will now have more access to education. If they can learn these subjects in their language, he says, I think that will only strengthen the knowledge and mastery of science, the knowledge and mastery of literature, the knowledge about the world around us. In many schools, instruction is done in the local language rather than in French. Balo says the next step is to translate Mali's other national languages, like Fulani and Songhai, into Braille. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Everybody needs somebody, somebody, somebody. Oh, yeah. Everybody needs somebody, somebody.
Everybody need a special someone. Break a day to make you smile. Break a dry, I love the tears from your eyes. Everybody need that special love. We go always hold your hands. Break a day with you and through the end. You know you need that special feeling. Feeling where they give you friendly. One we go there for you. You wanna go for you. Every night and day, no go ever use you play. Not the kind one when you need, not the kind love when you need. Everybody needs somebody, somebody, oh, somebody. Everybody needs somebody, somebody, oh, somebody. Everybody needs somebody, somebody, oh, somebody. Everybody needs somebody, somebody, oh, somebody.
Yeah. When you're looking in the mirror, see you. You inside my heart, girl. Everybody, everybody needs somebody just to be happy. The one and only in this world, there's you, my angel.
Imewasha kingdom, keti mbatu kukon, tukuteke kwa chom, fenana Papa Jones, Nadia up and the don, tosi mpati kufon, nasikia ako salon, tulomi do the bomb, clap pia imikrom, bogi mbaka yangon, mebambika na song, zile sihu perform, rende pia ni wrong, peko juu ya nyama ya bama na kachumbari, na juu ya diabetes chati weki sukari, plan size imetufikishe uko kari yako, walevi washanza kuleo, mekali ya floor, anasikia form ni kutesa, tusimalize kaji gomta turudi kalesa, Wakanesa, mavodo bila chesa, hakuna kulala, tunakisha
kutesa. Kutesa.
Cause Leonie Contessa.
kuteka.
Give you some time, my sweet Timothy, my yeah.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor Bill Eagle, Reporter Douglas Impuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, there are many a good tune played on an old fiddle. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.